inventing radiocarbon dating, allowing scientists to get an accurate reading of the age of bones and other organic remains, something they had never been able to do before. Up to this time, the oldest reliable dates went back no further than the first dynasty in Egypt from about 3000 BC. No one could confidently say, for instance, when the last ice sheets had retreated, or at what time in the past the Cro-Magnon people had decorated the caves of Lascaux in France. Libby's idea was so useful that he would be awarded a Nobel Prize for it in 1960. It was based on the realization that all living things have within them an isotope of carbon called carbon-14, which begins to decay at a measurable rate the instant they die. Carbon-14 has a half-life, that is the time it takes for half of any sample to disappear, of about 5,600 years. So by working out how much a given sample of carbon had decayed, Livy could get a good fix on the age of an object, though only up to a point. After 8 half-lives, only 1/256th of the original radioactive carbon remains, which is too little to make a reliable measurement. So radiocarbon dating works only for objects up to 40,000 or so years old. If you ever wondered how the atoms determine which 50% will die and which 50% will survive for the next session, the answer is that the half-life is really just a statistical convenience, a kind of actuarial table for elemental things. Imagine you had a sample of material with a half-life of 30 seconds. It isn't that every atom in the sample will exist for exactly 30 seconds, or 60 seconds, or 90 seconds, or some other tidily ordained period. Each atom will, in fact, survive for an entirely random length of time that has nothing to do with multiples of 30. It might last until 2 seconds from now, or it might oscillate away for years, or decades, or centuries to come. No one can say. But what we can say is that for the sample as a whole, the rate of disappearance will be such that half the atoms will disappear every 30 seconds. It's an average rate, in other words, and you can apply it to any large sampling. Someone once worked out, for instance, that dimes have a half-life of about 30 years. Curiously, just as the technique was becoming widespread, certain flaws within it became apparent. To begin with, it was discovered that one of the basic components of Libby's formula, known as the decay constant, was off by about 3%. By this time, however, thousands of measurements had been taken throughout the world. Rather than restate every one, scientists decided to keep the inaccurate constant. Thus, Tim Flannery notes, every raw radiocarbon date you read today is given as too young by around 3%. The problems didn't quite stop there. It was also quickly discovered that carbon-14 samples can be easily contaminated with carbon from other sources. A tiny scrap of vegetable matter, for instance, that has been collected with the sample and not noticed. For younger samples, those under 20,000 years or so, slight contamination does not always matter so much, but for older samples, it can be a serious problem because so few remaining atoms are being counted. In the first instance, to borrow from Flannery, it is like miscounting by a dollar when counting to 1,000. In the second, it is more like miscounting by a dollar when you have only $2 to count. Libby's method was also based on the assumption that the amount of carbon-14 in the atmosphere and the rate at which it has been absorbed by living things has been consistent throughout history. In fact, it hasn't been. We now know that the volume of atmospheric carbon-14 varies depending on how well or not Earth's magnetism is deflecting cosmic rays, and that that can vary significantly over time. This means that some carbon-14 dates are more dubious than others. This is particularly so with dates just around the time that people first came to the Americas, which is one of the reasons the matter is so perennially in dispute. Finally, and perhaps a little unexpectedly, readings can be thrown out by seemingly unrelated external factors, such as the diets of those whose bones are being tested. One recent case involved the long-running debate over whether syphilis originated in the New World or the Old. Archaeologists in Hull, in the north of England, found that monks in a monastery graveyard had suffered from syphilis, but the initial conclusion that the monks had done so before Columbus's voyage was cast into doubt by the realization that they had eaten a lot of fish, which could make their bones appear to be older than in fact they were. The monks may well have had syphilis, but how it got to them and when remained tantalizingly unresolved. Because of the accumulated shortcomings of carbon-14, scientists devised other methods of dating ancient materials. Among them, thermoluminescence, which measures electrons trapped in clays, and electron spin resonance, which involves bombarding a sample with electromagnetic waves and measuring the vibrations of the electrons. But even the best of these could not date anything older than about 200,000 years, and they couldn't date inorganic materials like rocks at all, which is, of course, what you need if you wish to determine the age of your planet. The problems of dating rocks were such that at one point almost everyone in the world had given up on them. Had it not been for a determined English professor named Arthur Holmes, the quest might well have fallen into abeyance altogether. Holmes was heroic as much for the obstacles he overcame as for the results he achieved. By the 1920s, when Holmes was in the prime of his career, geology had slipped out of fashion. Physics was the new excitement of the age and had become severely underfunded, particularly in Britain, its spiritual birthplace. At Durham University, Holmes was for many years the entire geology department. Often he had to borrow or patch together equipment in order to pursue his radiometric dating of rocks. At one point, his calculations were effectively held up for a year while he waited for the university to provide him with a simple adding machine. Occasionally, he had to drop out of academic life altogether to earn enough to support his family. For a time, he ran a curio shop in Newcastle-upon-Tyne. And sometimes he could not even afford the £5 annual membership fee for the Geological Society. The technique Holmes used in his work was theoretically straightforward and arose directly from the process first observed by Ernest Rutherford in 1904, in which some atoms decay from one element into another at a rate predictable enough that you can use them as clocks. If you know how long it takes for potassium-40 to become argon-40, and you measure the amounts of each in a sample, you can work out how old a material is. Holmes's contribution was to measure the decay rate of uranium into lead to calculate the age of rocks, and thus, he hoped,